This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Plan A was to drown him. Plan B was to stab him.
These are the written words of Delaware Department of Corrections inmate Frank Ross. They're taken from letters that he wrote to us in 2019.
The fact that I went back to Plan A, after Plan B was carried out, tells me I was not in my right frame of mind.
I'm documentary producer Ned Parker, and Frank Ross is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Zoe Hines and I have corresponded with in our work investigating violent crime and the lives of the people who enact it.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 8, Deadly Coercion.
Able 911.
The murderous woman, or femme fatale, is a staple character in Hollywood films. But many criminologists and investigators are at pains to point out that fiction is often a far cry from reality. In 1998, an FBI agent named Roy Hazelwood went as far as to proclaim that there was no such thing as a female serial killer. This bold statement has, of course, sadly been disproven, but it does reflect a strangely popular misconception that, in real life, murder is somehow the preserve of men. It is true that men commit murders far more frequently than women, but there are plenty of female murderers. And in many of the cases that we've investigated, we've often discovered that a second, female protagonist was involved in some way. The case for this episode is one such example because, although our killer and letter writer is a man, there is no denying that there was also a woman who played a significant role in the ending of somebody's life. But to what extent? Did she simply help to facilitate the crime? Or was she the driving force behind it?
In this particular case, we're not asking ourselves who, because Frank Ross is very clear that he carried out the crime. Instead, we're asking ourselves why.
Why did Frank Ross murder his victim? And was he fully conscious of his reasons for doing so? How culpable should someone be for their actions if they were possibly influenced or even manipulated by another person?
Before we explore the letters written by Frank Ross, let's hear the details of his case file.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. April 1980. Frank Ross, a 23-year-old Navy dropout, arrived at the home of William McBride near Dover, Michigan. At the property, Ross was met by McBride's wife, Judith McBride, who informed Ross that her husband had eaten a meal that she had made for him, and that she had watched as the Valium it was laced with had slowly sent him into a deep sleep. Judith McBride then exited the apartment while Ross prepared to murder her husband. He struck William McBride with a whiskey bottle several times until it smashed. But instead of rendering McBride fully unconscious, this violent act awoke him from his drug-induced sleep. Using a knife he had brought with him, Ross stabbed and slashed at his victim before finally killing him with a stab to the head. After meticulously gathering incriminating evidence into a bag, Ross left the apartment, then walked back to Judith's house, where he boiled the murder weapon before destroying his boots and coat. 3 days later, he left Dover and returned to his parents' home, also in Michigan. Less than 2 weeks after the murder, Frank Ross and Judith McBride were arrested.
This is a vicious and premeditated murder, and one that was clearly planned by at least two individuals, Frank Ross himself and the victim's wife, Judith McBride. I'm immediately interested to know the relationship between these two parties. I would assume that that connection was romantic, and I think I would naturally lean towards the idea that this was a crime carried out by two lovers who for some reason wanted Judith's husband out of the way.
But actually, it's far from that. Frank Ross and Judith McBride weren't the only ones involved in the murder of William McBride. Judith McBride's lover was involved, but that person was not Frank Ross. He's another man called Robert Creeder. And as we'll hear in his letters, Ross was brought into this strange triangle by this man.
But why Ross agreed to carry out the murder of Judith McBride's husband isn't entirely clear. Was he coerced into the murder by two strangers? When we first approached Frank Ross by letter, we asked him to write about his childhood years, and he wrote back to us explaining that he was one of two brothers, separated by 7 years, and it seems it was not a particularly happy upbringing, something that he lays squarely at the feet of his father.
Let's hear the first extract from his letters. As ever, these are the words of an actor, but they are all Frank Ross's words, as written to us from prison.
I don't remember ever really being happy as a child. I was a shy and timid child who needed a lot of support and encouragement and never really felt like I got any, especially from my father. I could have been the kind of son who idolized his father and wanted to be just like him. But he seemed to despise my very existence. He always came back from work so angry that I did not want to be anywhere around. But he always demanded I be home, but wanted me to go to my room and be quiet. My only brother was born 6 weeks after I turned 7, and he and I shared a room that was the same size as the cell I now live in. Two boys are not going to be in a room that small without one of them clowning around. My father would burst into the room, hitting and spanking and yelling at us for making noise. He never used his fist or drew blood, but a belt, a paddle, or even an open hand hurts. And it happened a lot. My brother admits it got worse. Our father used to like to squeeze toes and fingers, which really hurt. One of the doctors who testified at my trial said, subconsciously, I was murdering my father.
Straight away, we recognize the familiar theme of a violent childhood upbringing.
But it's also shocking that he writes how the court drew a direct comparison between seeking revenge on his father and murdering his victim.
Ross continues in his letters to claim that he was a good kid, but the violence of his father overshadowed him.
My father demanded my brother and I went to bed at 9 p.m., even as teenagers. I never stayed out late or snuck out, never went to any teen drinking parties. I never drank until I was old enough to buy my own. I drank a lot in the Navy and got in trouble a couple of times. One doctor said I went through a delayed adolescence.
So I think we should describe the way that Frank Ross's letters are written to us at this point. He's handwriting them, and his writing is in block script. It's not joined up, which immediately gives them this sort of childlike impression. And it's not just the form of the letters that signposts us towards this sense of Frank Ross being a child. It's also in the content when he points us toward the statement that one doctor said he had a delayed adolescence.
But it goes beyond just that. Ross's psychological state is something that will come up later when we get to the court case, where questions were raised about his mental capacity. And there was certainly a narrative put forward in court that Ross was very much the babe in the woods character of these three conspirators, the three who were involved in the murder.
Ross apparently always wanted to be a Michigan State Trooper, but his eyesight wasn't good enough to pass the entrance exam. So instead, he enlisted in the Navy as an 18-year-old in 1975, which was 5 years before he committed the murder. Ross explains how it was after he was discharged from the Navy that he met Judith McBride and Robert Creeder.
After my honorable discharge, I had a wanderlust and was staying with an old Navy buddy in Florida. On my 23rd birthday, I went to the Sugar Shack, a Jacksonville go-go bar, to have a beer. That is where I met my male co-defendant. He was working with a construction crew out of Michigan. All the guys liked me. One offered me a job back in Michigan, but I came to Delaware with my co-defendant. He introduced me to my female co-defendant. Both were 12 years older than me. Judy was 5 feet 2, 98 pounds, and had a way of making me feel good about myself. And to feel sorry for her. Almost from the first night I met Judy, talk turned to planning, and planning turned into action. It was only 2 months after meeting her that I murdered her husband.
It's interesting to read that Ross claims Judith McBride had a way of
making me feel good about myself and to feel sorry for her.
Especially if you think about the childlike innocence of his block handwriting and his reference to delayed adolescence. There's a naivety to this statement. And Ross also stresses it was only 8 weeks after meeting these two that he went on to murder William McBride.
It is a shockingly quick turnaround to meet somebody and then become involved in a crime of that nature with them. And it suggests that Frank Ross was maybe searching for someone to guide him after having left the Navy, or that he was very suggestible or easily influenced. But for me, I think it's a bit hard to tell from the letter whether he's trying to make a point of this timeline in order to mitigate his own responsibility, or if perhaps he's boasting about the speed of which this crime was put into action.
Ross also writes that it was on the first night he met Creda that he was told about Judith McBride, who Creda claimed was being abused by her husband.
I don't think there was such a woman. He just wanted to see if such things bothered me.
The suggestion by Creda that Judith McBride's husband was a wife-beater who sexually abused her is one which is very difficult to substantiate, certainly at this point in time. But it is clear from what Ross has written here that Creda was testing him in some way. And assuming that he's telling us the truth, the question is this something that Ross is now trying to use as a justification for his actions? Or is it that he's suggesting that he's essentially been brainwashed by these two virtual strangers who are both much older than him?
It does seem clear from his letters that these accusations about William McBride did have a big effect on Ross, certainly emotionally, because he claims that they were instrumental in convincing him to go ahead and carry out this murder.
I saw my victim twice before the murder, but only knew him by what Judy told me. I was raised to believe that wife beaters, child molesters, and rapists were the scum of the earth. And Judy painted her husband as all of these. I never really felt like I had done wrong. It took a few years for the guilt to really set in.
Judith and her husband, the victim, William McBride, were actually separated. William had been married before. He had three children from that marriage, and he'd only been married to Judith for a couple of years. The two of them had been living in separate homes for at least 3 months, and Ross had been living with Judith and with Creda in her home, so he was very aware that the separation had taken place.
That does raise questions about how much Ross might have genuinely believed she was a woman in a position of danger. Was it perhaps clear to him that Judith wasn't actually in any immediate danger from her husband? And if so, what does that tell us about his motivation for carrying out this crime?
Let's listen to how Frank Ross writes about the night of the murder itself, which had apparently been meticulously planned by Judith McBride, Creda and Ross. But as we'll hear, events didn't work out anywhere near as neatly as intended.
The murder is a tough one. I'm at Judy's house, waiting for her call. She's at the victim's apartment. She calls me and tells me it's a go. My male co-defendant gives me a ride to the apartment. I tap on the door. Judy lets me in. She had sex with her husband, and she put Valium in his food. She shows me where he's sleeping. And although she was supposed to help me with the murder, she said she did not want to be there. So I let her leave. Plan A was to drown him. Plan B was to stab him. Judy knew I had the knife. I hit him with a whiskey bottle, which was inside my Navy ditty bag. This woke him up, and he rolled to the other side of the bed. I struck at him with the knife, cutting his chest. To this day, I do not know if he said, "You cut me, man," or "You made me bleed, man." But we looked at each other for a second or two. I moved the knife to my right hand, jumped across the bed, pinning him to the wall with my left hand, and stabbing him until he slid down the wall. I then dragged his body to the bathroom and dumped his body into the tub. Judy had pre-filled the tub with water and said she wanted him found there as part of Plan A. The fact that I went back to Plan A after Plan B was carried out tells me I was not in my right frame of mind. When I walked out, Judy was in the car waiting and offered me a ride back to her house. I told her I had blood on me and should not get in the car.
This part of his letters is, of course, very upsetting. But for me, it is also really interesting because there seems to be a massive confusion between what the plan was and what actually happened.
If it wasn't such a horrific sequence of events, it would almost be farcical. Here you have Ross referring to a plan A and to a plan B, which in principle seems to be the backup option. But clearly what he and the others had been planning for was for this to appear as an accidental death.
Plan A was to drown him. Plan B was to stab him.
What then seems really bizarre is that he goes on to plan B, but still dumps the body in the bath.
It's like he's confused about what the point of plan A actually is. And Ross says he wasn't in his right frame of mind at that point when he dumped McBride's body in the bathtub. Now, we've seen him pepper in his letters these references to what the doctors and psychologists have said about him, backing up his various states of mind and the mitigating circumstances that explain his behaviour. So maybe it's just a case of him really trying to push this denigrated state of mind explanation.
But I do feel we're starting to get a picture of this kind of skittish incompetence. And it all connects to the fact that there were questions raised about Ross's mental ability and makes me strongly wonder if we're dealing with somebody who was really fully able to understand what he was doing.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? Well, this podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. They're an online counselling service that will assess your personal needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. It's not a crisis line or self-help, it's therapy at your fingertips. Professional counselling done securely online.
Visit their website and read the testimonials that are posted daily. Here are some success stories. Sharon is incredibly intuitive. She provides empathy while incorporating medical knowledge and intuition. Compassion is given with truth, honesty, and guidance for healing and growth. Also, I'm amazed that I can connect with a counsellor online using this platform. Tonya listens, provides solutions, and helps me create powerful affirmations to rewire my brain and manifest positive transformation. She's gentle but affirming, and I'm looking forward to continuing this healing journey with her guidance.
BetterHelp is available wherever you are in the world, and you can start communicating with a licensed professional therapist in under 48 hours. Log into your account at betterhelp.com anytime and send a message to your counsellor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions.
BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counsellors if needed. And it's more affordable than traditional offline counselling. Financial aid is also available.
Visit betterhelp.com to read more. And join over a million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and listeners to Letters from a Killer will get 10% off their first month when they visit betterhelp.com/LFAK.
When I was looking at the case notes, I found this extract published by the Supreme Court of Delaware, and it comes from his appeal hearing in 1983, and it says, Ross pinned McBride against the wall and continued to stab him until McBride's body slid down the wall and sank to the floor. Not content with that, Ross made one final thrust with a knife downward into McBride's eye. The force was so great that Ross had to put his boot on McBride's head to pull the knife out. In his letters to us, Ross completely leaves out this part where he allegedly stabbed McBride through the eye socket with so much force that he then had to wrench the knife loose by holding his skull down with his boot.
Those details have obviously been extrapolated from the post-mortem, but just because that's the narrative presented in court doesn't necessarily mean that's 100% true. And I do think that when an event is recalled, it's highly likely that details are left out or misremembered over time. Having said that, you would think that a part of the action so graphic would potentially be difficult to forget.
Ross has never denied committing the murder, and he's never tried to place anyone else in the room when it happened. So when it came to court, he pled guilty.
So does this suggest that Ross is consciously leaving certain details out of his otherwise detailed account to us? Let's hear from Ross's letters again. He writes about being arrested and what was going through his head as he processed that he had been captured and arrested for murder.
After the crime, I returned to Michigan and was arrested on my parents' front porch. I guess they knew it was bad, but they didn't know how bad. At the police station, they let me be alone with my parents, and I told the truth. My mother begged me to tell the police, but later said she did not believe me. I was in jail in Michigan for 5 days and then taken to Delaware. I asked the Delaware police if Delaware had the death penalty. They assured me it did, and I would be put to death if convicted. It was then that I confessed. I wanted to be executed.
Frank Ross was arrested in Michigan, but he was then taken back to Delaware, where murder is a capital offence with the death penalty, and it was there that Ross chose to confess in order to be executed.
It certainly doesn't seem as if the prospect of a death sentence deterred Ross in any way from offering that confession. And there are many studies where it's been stated that the death penalty doesn't actually act as a deterrent to prevent violent crime or murder in any case. If he'd known that the death penalty was a potential sentence for his acts or not, I don't think would really have affected the outcome, and it certainly doesn't seem to have affected his desire to confess and plead guilty to this crime.
It's very difficult for us to speculate on that, especially when all you have available to you are letters and court transcripts. We should note here that Delaware has, in fact, abolished the death penalty now, but they didn't do that until 2016. So with that in mind, let's hear the verdict on Frank Ross's case.
Letters from a Killer. The verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. June 1980. After waiving preliminary hearings, Judith McBride and Frank Ross were each indicted for murder in the first degree and conspiracy in the first degree. September 1981. Frank Ross was separately tried before a jury in Superior Court, Kent County. He was found guilty as charged and sentenced to life imprisonment without the benefit of probation or parole. March 1982. Judith McBride was tried before a jury in Superior Court, Kent County, She was also found guilty as charged and sentenced to life imprisonment without the benefit of probation or parole. April 1995. Ross made an appeal to the State Pardons Board for his sentence of life without parole to be commuted. This appeal was rejected and also denied a second time in 2015. Frank Ross is still in the James T. Vaughn Correctional Center in Delaware to this very day.
The fact that Frank Ross attempted to appeal his sentence might suggest that his request for the death penalty wasn't born out of a sense of mea culpa, of some knowledge he'd done wrong. But instead, it could be born out of a sense that he's going to have to suffer more by being kept alive in jail, which is arguably less remorseful and a way of putting his suffering to an end. But our final question in relation to these letters has to be, to what degree can we assess that Judith McBride coerced Frank Ross into killing her husband? If we take the other co-defendant Robert Creeder out of the equation and place Judith McBride and Frank Ross on an equal set of scales and try to find a balance of culpability between them, who is most to blame?
From a legal perspective on who's to blame, we have already heard the verdict. But I think, interestingly, that isn't for me the end of the story. So I'm going to leave you with this final thought, because what happens afterwards, I think, is possibly the most revealing aspects of this case. In 2011, Judith McBride succeeded in being released following an appeal to the state governor. Now, we have heard, of course, that Frank Ross's appeals were denied twice. So she's been free for a decade, but Ross remains in prison. And after Judith McBride was released by the governor, Frank Ross himself wrote to that same governor, and he's included a copy of that letter in his correspondence to us. He starts by pointing out that despite asking for the death penalty himself, his jury didn't reach a unanimous decision to put him to death. In fact, they voted unanimously to spare him from the death penalty. But in Judith McBride's case, 8 members of her jury voted to give her the death penalty. Now, these are different juries, but it does show a different perception of these two defendants as they're going through their legal process. Ross also claims in his letter to the governor, which he would have known was being put on record, that Judith McBride had also not behaved well in prison, that she'd allegedly attempted to escape, and also he makes claims that she'd had sex with staff at the prison, namely prison guards, one of whom was dismissed as a result of that. But there is more, because Ross also explains to us that he was apparently forgiven by the children of William McBride, whereas Judith, he says, has had no forgiveness from the McBride family. A victim's family, obviously, they're not the judge, they're not the jury, but I think it's illuminating to know how they perceive two individuals who are both convicted for their differing roles in a crime. So we looked into it, and in some research we found a newspaper article where the son of the victim had given an interview at the point that he'd heard that Judith McBride was being released. And what he said was, I quote, "It doesn't matter to me. She's 64 years old. Look at her. She's a pathetic human being. This just means someone else has to take care of her healthcare." And in this same article, he also tells the reporter that as far as he's concerned, Frank Ross understands why he is where he is. But Judith McBride, he refers to as a sociopath.
Well, that shines a very different light on the scenario, positioning Frank Ross almost as a victim, with Judith McBride as a conspiratorial, manipulative person who got what she wanted.
In this episode, we've explored the letters of Frank Ross, and we've looked at issues surrounding culpability when someone might be under the influence of manipulative people.
The fact that I went back to Plan A after Plan B was carried out tells me I was not in my right frame of mind.
It is very difficult to pass judgment when you're dealing with an individual who, even though they are clearly guilty, had quite possibly been coerced by others into that crime, and who even goes as far as to ask to be executed for their role.
But is that enough of a reason to lock him up for life? Especially when you consider the fact that the person who apparently coerced that individual into murder has now been released. It does beg the question, should we view the act of coercive manipulation itself as worthy of the same judicial treatment as murder.
Next time on Letters from a Killer, murder me.
My first cellmate told the guards on Sunday morning that I told him I was going to kill a guard to seek the death penalty. Two of them pulled me out and beat me really bad. I knew I should have killed my first cellmate when I had the chance.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.